You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In 1980, Victor Denoble went to work for Philip Morris, leading an in-house research laboratory to find a substitute for nicotine in cigarettes. The goal was to maintain the addictive properties of cigarettes, but eliminate their adverse effects on other parts of the body. Mr. Denoble's research was abruptly ended only 4 years later, and soon after that, he was fired. In a documentary called Addiction Incorporated, filmmaker Charles Evans Jr. examines Denoble's trajectory from research scientist to the very first whistleblower against the industry at a time when the major tobacco companies still claimed nicotine was not addictive. The film opens today at the Film Forum for a two-week run, and I'm very pleased to welcome to our show both Victor Denoble and Charles Evans, Jr. Hello.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Charles, when did you first hear about Victor Denoble?
I first heard about Victor in 1994 when he testified to Congress and wanted to know more and pursued him personally and met with him and optioned his rights to make a movie in 1996.
Well, that's a long time ago.
Yeah.
In the last two decades, there's been considerable media coverage and even movies made about whistleblowers and the tobacco industry. Didn't the story occur before the events depicted in The Insider?
Yes. Victor was the first person to testify outside of about the industry from within the industry. And that's one of the points that this film makes. And because of the big impression that these that the CEOs made when they swore it wasn't addictive, and Victor directly refuted that 2 weeks later in the same room. It was so deeply impressed in people's brains that they associated the film The Insider with all of these congressional hearings and that scandal.
Well, you come from a feature film background, including production work on films like The Aviator. Why did you decide to tell the story as a documentary?
Because the tobacco industry wasn't going away. The bad guy wasn't going down as you need in a narrative film, and they kept going forward, and I knew that I had to find a way to end the movie, a way to tell the story of a very dark industry through the eyes of a very bright hero.
And Victor, the film begins depicting you as something of a Lost Valley Stream kid who discovered himself when he overcame dyslexia and also learned that he loved science and math.
Yes, very much so. As a child, I had dyslexia. I still have dyslexia, obviously. But as a child, we didn't know what that was. And it was very difficult for me to concentrate and read. And it wasn't until actually I went to college that I was diagnosed with dyslexia. And then once I could read, it was much, much better.
What had you been doing prior to being hired by Philip Morris?
I was working at the University of Minnesota. I was doing a postdoc fellowship at the university, and I was studying drug addiction, specifically narcotics and alcohol in animals.
And they approached you because of that?
Correct. I was one of the very few people in the world that was doing what they call self-administration. This is where animals give themselves drugs. And it was a very new technique back in the early 80s. And I got a call from Bill Dunn from Philip Morris, and he said, we have a job for you.
What did they say they were looking to do, and what specifically did they want you to do?
Well, Philip Morris had a program beginning in about the 70s where they wanted to remove nicotine from tobacco and replace it with another addictive drug. Nicotine was believed to be the trigger for cardiovascular disease. And they had this program where they made all these molecules. They had no way to test these molecules. So they hired me basically to say, here's a bunch of rats. Do their brains like it? And can we remove the cardiovascular effects?
Did you have any reservations at the time about working for a tobacco company?
Oh, gosh, no.
Had you been a smoker?
No. My mother and father both smoked. My sister smokes. And it came from a smoking family and household. But you got to bring yourself back to 1980 when I joined Philip Morris. I mean, in 1980, you could smoke anywhere in the country.
But we already knew that it was related to lung cancer, emphysema, heart conditions, whole bunch of things.
Yeah, but as a scientist, here's a company coming to you and saying, you know, we know our product hurts people, and we'd like you to help us remove that. As a young scientist, that was my dream.
So you set up a laboratory in their headquarters?
Correct. Down in Richmond, Virginia, yes.
And what were you doing? What kinds of studies were you conducting?
We were making animal models of drug addiction. Animal models can predict what happens to people, and animals can get addicted to drugs.
So you were addicting rats to drugs?
Actually, they're addicting themselves, which is that's the fascinating point. You know, they give themselves the drug and they get addicted. Their brain gets addicted to it. And the animal model is so much cleaner because animals don't have social pressure. They don't have, you know, peer pressure. They don't lose their jobs. They're getting addicted to the drug because their brain says, I like it.
And it was okay with you to addict these rats to drugs? Because eventually you were going to apply this to humans.
Correct. Well, the reason we do animal research is you want to make models to help people. And what's really nice is today, of course, we don't have to use as many animals because we've done it in the past.
And this was a secret experiment being done within Philip Morris.
Yes, the laboratory was built in secrecy. Very few people in the whole company knew that we were there. Almost nobody knew what we were doing except top management.
Charles, before the early 1980s, what sort of scientific research had the tobacco companies or others conducted about smoking and all of those serious medical conditions that were related to it? Hadn't people made links with lung cancer as early as the 50s?
Yes, that link was made in 1952. It was tar was linked to producing cancer on the skin of mice, and it really jump-started the industry's research and mostly into producing data that would vindicate them and not be condemning while putting on a very forward face of caring for their customers and promising to look out for their best interests.
Well, they had stopped running ads like 4 out of 5 doctors recommend smoking Camels or whatever the cigarette was. What were they saying in the face of the scientific data that suggested they were making a product that killed people?
The effect of those disclosure of those studies, and they could have been very, very damaging to the industry. They all came together, competing companies came together and agreed to put on a united front and agreed that they would put a lot of money into an institute that whose purpose was allegedly to produce science in the public interest, and it was in reality a public relations. For half their money was spent on public relations and the other half was making science that would not be damaging.
My guess is Charles Evans Jr., who's made a film called Addiction Incorporated, that premieres at the Film Forum today. It'll be running through the 27th. Also with us is Victor DeNoble, who is if this were a feature film, you would be the main character, the protagonist of the film. So when Philip Morris hired you, you must have been aware that cigarettes had been linked to lung cancer, emphysema, heart disease, and that they were addictive. You were hoping to make them less dangerous?
Yes. If you think back to the 80s, I didn't think anybody in the world back then thought that tobacco smoking would ever be banned or limited. And if you're going to produce a product that you know does harm to people, you better work on that product to make it do less harm.
First, you had to find out what nicotine does to us. What did you discover?
Exactly what we always thought it was. Nicotine is an addictive drug. It's just like cocaine and morphine and heroin and alcohol. It changes the way a person's brain works. It actually sets up a situation where a person who doesn't have nicotine in their brain, they feel uncomfortable. And that's what happens is people use tobacco products because they change the way their brain functions.
Well, some people will tell you that they can smoke whenever they want to and they never become addicted.
Yeah, you know, that statement is absolutely true, by the way. You can do the same thing with cocaine and heroin. There are some people who use heroin only on the weekends or maybe only use cocaine on the weekends. The vast majority of people who experiment with drugs will get addicted to drugs. You're going to have those 3 to 5% of people in any drug addiction population that can be resistant.
So was your research successful? Were you discovering the sorts of things they wanted you to discover?
Yes, in 1982, we actually discovered a molecule that the rat said, my brain likes it, and the rat's heart said, I have no problem with it. In fact, we even designed a mock cigarette for the development people to remove nicotine and put our drug in there. We were successful, yes.
This so-called safe cigarette. What was the drug that you came up with?
It was called 2-prime-methyl nicotine. It was a methylated form of nicotine. The interesting thing, though, is being young and many, many years earlier, it wouldn't have worked. We were wrong.
But it was important that it still be addictive, They
Correct.
Didn't want to create cigarettes that you could smoke and then lay off of for a while and then smoke another one casually somewhere down the line.
Yes, the drug that we discovered was absolutely still as addictive as nicotine. In fact, in late 82, early 83, we discovered a second drug in tobacco that aids the addiction to nicotine.
Now, Charles, executives and lawyers at Philip Morris were closely watching these studies. Why do you suppose they brought in a scientist who would provide scientific documentation that could be a liability for them?
There was a split between Richmond and New York. New York was where the lawyers and the executives were, the people who sold the product and who defended against litigation. And the Philip Morris Research Center in Richmond was led largely by scientists who wanted to push their, you know, produce innovations that would guarantee a market share in the future. And I think that's – they were being led by scientists who weren't concerned about the legal exposure.
But around this time, there were also lawsuits being brought against the tobacco companies. What was the basis of them?
The industry had a perfect record at that time of defending against lawsuits that had been filed for injury, and the basis was that the product was causing terminal diseases, and they hadn't had a lawsuit in a while, and Victor's research started at a time before what came to be known as the second wave in 1983.
But they had won all those earlier lawsuits. In effect, they said you were the person who developed the emphysema, had the lung cancer, whatever, was aware that this could cause health problems and continue to smoke. And so it was really his or her responsibility.
They had become a little complacent, and they allowed Victor to start his research, and then a lawsuit was filed, and the climate changed.
Well, you had developed this thing, a chemical compound, acetaldehyde, that enhanced the strength of nicotine.
Correct.
So you would take most of the nicotine out, put this thing in, and it would enhance and make it just as effective as if the nicotine was at full strength?
You could do that. You could reduce the nicotine and add more acetaldehyde. And the other thing you could do is keep the nicotine stable and add acetaldehyde to make it more addictive. And
that's, even more addictive.
Absolutely. And that's,
well, I was pretty addicted when I smoked, and that was without acetaldehyde.
Actually, acetaldehyde naturally occurs when you light up a cigarette, so it's in there. You were getting acetaldehyde as well. And I think what Charlie pointed out was, for the first time in 1983, one of the lawsuits that was filed was the Cipollone case. And that lawsuit didn't say cancer. That lawsuit said addiction. And that sent everything down the tubes.
Well, what did you plan on doing with your information? Just passing it on to your superiors?
No, Dr. Mealy and I, my associate Paul and I, we tried to publish the information in 1982. We actually got a paper out there to be published. It was accepted by a premier journal, and the tobacco industry, Philip Morris, made us remove that paper.
And Charles, is that because they thought it might incriminate them in some way?
Certainly. The lawsuit had been filed. They had a team of lawyers going through the Philip Morris Research Center, and they wrote a finding that it all had to be shut down.
We'll take a little break, and when we come back, we'll talk more with Charles Evans, Jr., whose film Addiction Incorporated opens today at the Film Forum on West Houston Street. It'll run through December 27th. Also with us is Victor DeNoble, the scientist who's responsible for the research that the film deals with, and later was the whistleblower who pretty much blew the lid on what the tobacco industry was doing. Stay with us. We're back with Victor DeNoble, the subject of Charles Evans Jr.'s film Addiction Incorporated, which opens today at the Film Forum and runs through December 27th. Okay, so Victor,
yes,
you were brought into your boss's office, and what were you told?
We were told that they no longer do research in the area of behavioral pharmacology, which is what we do, and that we should go downstairs and kill the rats and leave the company.
So you and your colleague Paul Mealy were fired right after that?
Yes. In fact, we were fired on April 5th, 1984, and we were told to leave the building.
Well, it sounds like they were being rather hostile.
Actually, they weren't being hostile. I'm sure it was a business decision. And to be honest with you, they did offer us 6 months' worth of pay. I mean, they didn't abandon us at all, but they made it clear they were not going to let this research be known.
And they reminded you that you had signed an ironclad confidentiality agreement?
Oh, they reminded us very clearly that this agreement was a lifelong agreement and that if we divulged information, we would be subject to litigation.
If you hadn't been fired and the study had simply not been published, do you think you would have stayed with the company?
No. By 1984, Paul and I had research papers that were suppressed. We were told we couldn't present it in scientific meetings. That's not something a scientist wants to do. We began to lose faith about a year and a half before we were fired, and it was clear to me that we would have, you know, left under different circumstances and tried to get the information out.
So where did you work after this?
I left and was hired into a pharmaceutical company in New Jersey, and I was doing Alzheimer's disease research. Paul left and went to the Walter Reed Army Hospital in Bethesda, Maryland, doing research for the Army.
Charles, 10 years after Victor was fired, there was renewed media interest in the tobacco story. What were some media outlets uncovering at the time?
ABC did a pioneering report on the addictiveness of tobacco and the fact that the industry was manipulating nicotine levels and could, in effect, they knew that nicotine was addictive.
It sounds brave, but there was a lot of trouble getting that story on the air, wasn't there?
There was, and it happened this – everyone thinks they know the story of tobacco. They continue to hear stories regularly that gives you little snapshots of issues related with that industry, and – at the time, people thought they knew it all about the industry, and they didn't.
Well, the resistance to running it on ABC was that the lawyers were concerned, and they had every reason to be. They were sued for $10 billion by the tobacco industry.
But even before that show aired, there wasn't much interest within ABC. They thought a tobacco story is not that big a deal, and it coincided with the FDA deciding to pursue an investigation into the industry, and that elevated the show within ABC, and that led to the lawsuit.
And that was 1994. The Federal Drug Administration launched this investigation into nicotine with Congressman Henry Waxman leading the effort. How did he obtain a copy of Victor's never-published study?
When I was working for Philip Morris, it's very common for a scientist to send his research out to be reviewed by a colleague before you send it to a journal because you're looking at it from rose-colored glasses. And I sent it to Jack Henningfield, a friend of mine, who happened to be at the time in 1994 the chief of the behavioral pharmacology unit. Jack is a pat rack. He kept everything, and he kept a copy of the paper.
And when you saw Representative Waxman holding up your paper on national television, what was your reaction?
Well, my heart stopped a few times. I mean, it was exciting, it was exhilarating, and it was so confusing about what was going to happen next. You know, how was this going to play out? Would the tobacco industry be able to use this to their advantage? And that was my concern.
Or come after you, because you had signed that confidentiality agreement. They might have suspected that you were the one who passed this information on.
You know, it's funny. I didn't think of that particular angle back then, but that's an interesting angle. I knew they were going to come after me somehow, but I wasn't sure which way.
But who came after you, actually? It was Congress.
Actually, yes. Congressman Waxman and Commissioner Kessler put an investigative team together, and they uncovered me.
Eventually, Waxman got the top tobacco CEOs to testify in front of the subcommittee, and they all denied that nicotine is addictive. Were they being naive in thinking that they could just simply get this thing to pass over?
I think they were being naive. I think they all thought that they had enough power in congressional members that this was not going to be uncomfortable for them. And in fact, it turned out to be one of the worst decisions they've ever made.
Because they had friends in tobacco-growing states.
Correct.
Who had come to their aid in the past.
Yes.
Now, why didn't that work this time?
one of the things, if you look back at the history of those congressional hearings, the anger of the people on the committee was as in somebody said, was palpable. They could feel it. So many people had died, and the tobacco industry had never admitted that nicotine was addictive or caused heart disease and cancer. And here you had seven seemingly very intelligent people on national TV admitting and saying, no, it doesn't cause these diseases, when everybody knew they were lying.
It also was a precedent-setting hearing because it was the first time that C-SPAN had publicized these hearings, oversight hearings would come and go, and there would be some congressional record, but who really goes and pours through the congressional records when you have it in pictures and sound nationwide? It left quite a mark.
In your film, you interviewed one of Philip Morris's lead attorneys in the case. Why would he agree to speak with you and be so open with you?
He, I think, has come to a slightly different approach over time that the industry has about their future and how what is their best interest going into the future. And I think he wanted to share facts that, you know, what they were thinking at the time. It's not incriminating. It's just a matter of fact.
But it's kind of damning, some of the things he said.
It gives...
It filled in gaps.
It filled in gaps, and it gives the feeling of balance that you are getting the other side, a window on their side.
Did you get anybody else from the tobacco industry to talk to you? On or off camera?
Paul Mallet, Victor's co-worker in the lab, and a fellow named Bill Ferrone, who is also a fellow scientist there, but no one else would go on record.
Victor, after you testified before Congress, you went to work for a New Orleans lawyer. What were you doing for his firm?
Wendell Gauthier was a lawyer from New Orleans who put together the Castano litigation group to sue the tobacco industry. And he did it because his best friend Peter Castano died from cancer. And Peter Castano could do anything except one thing, and that was quit smoking. And Wendell came to me and said, look, you know, we don't know anything about the tobacco industry, and you know everything. Can you teach us? And I went to work for him to help them understand what the tobacco industry knew and when.
Well, up until this time, there had been a number of class action lawsuits that had been filed against the tobacco companies, and the companies had always won, partly because they just were willing to spend as much money as was necessary on their legal defense. So is that what the plaintiffs were up against this time as well?
Very much so, but the difference was Wendell put together a group of 64 different law firms. So it wasn't just one law firm or two law firms. These were 64 law firms. I believe there was almost 400 lawyers involved. And that many law firms with that kind of power and that kind of money was the first time ever that the tobacco industry was in trouble.
And the addiction angle. They hadn't sued for addicting their customers and had always claimed that it was a product that was not addictive.
My guests are Charles Evans, Jr., the director of Addiction Incorporated, which premieres today at the Film Forum on West Houston Street. It will run through December 27th. Also with us is Victor DeNoble, who is a scientist who worked for the tobacco industry and later became a major whistleblower in changing the way the tobacco companies have conducted business ever since. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, another factor, Charles, was that states began going after the tobacco industry on behalf of taxpayers because of the burden of health care costs on them. How did the tobacco industry respond to that?
There was a state movement, Michael Moore in Mississippi, over a period of time, got a lot of lawyers to sign on to filing lawsuits on behalf of the states that had to pay a lot of Medicaid for tobacco-related illness, and this is a lot of money. If they had lost one of these lawsuits, they would have been bankrupted because we're talking about decades of expense that was at stake. A lot of information had come out that had never been seen before, stuff that would have made the difference between winning and losing a lawsuit.
But you say they had lost. You're talking about the tobacco companies. They would have been bankrupted.
The tobacco companies would have been bankrupted, and now that these documents had come public, the wherewithal was in the hands of the lawyer to win lawsuits. And they negotiated for the first time in their history to settle.
A multi-billion dollar settlement in 1997. And it wasn't just money. They also agreed to certain changes in their approach to the business.
Yes, there were a lot of things on the table. It was a very complicated deal, and federal oversight regulation was part of that, a component of that deal with the federal government.
Well, but Victor, you opposed it. Why?
I was opposed to it back then, and it's now law, so law is law. I don't know how you negotiate a person's life away. I mean, how much do we charge the tobacco industry for killing a person? Almost 500,000 people will die each year from tobacco products. And for me, this wasn't a political solution. For me, it was a moral and ethical solution. It still is today.
So you wanted to see them banned totally?
Absolutely.
Do you think that's possible? We saw prohibition not working.
I think it is possible, and hopefully the FDA will be moving in that direction. It's not going to happen tomorrow. It's not going to happen next week. It certainly might happen in 20 years.
Well, I throw this out to both of you. Since the early 90s, we've seen a huge decline in the numbers of smokers and a rise in anti-smoking policies across the country and the world. The taxes on cigarettes right now make them prohibitive for all but the most addicted. But what do you think still needs to be done to get people to stop smoking? People continue to smoke despite all of this.
You know, recently Congress passed the act, and President Obama signed it in 2009, and it considers tobacco an epidemic among young people. It's a pediatric disease. What needs to be done is that the level of nicotine in tobacco products needs to be reduced to the point at which somebody can try a tobacco product, they can experiment with it, and it won't lead to addiction.
Have the tobacco companies reduced the amount of nicotine in their cigarettes?
The tobacco companies have fought every ounce of regulation that's been proposed so far in the last 2 years. They are not going to lay down.
Now, what would happen if they did reduce the nicotine in at least one brand? Would that affect the quality of the smoke for the people who love cigarettes?
The tobacco industry marketed nicotine-free cigarettes back in the 1960s, and nobody would buy them. So it couldn't be one brand. People would just move to a different brand. You'd have to reduce the level of nicotine in all brands for this thing to be effective.
But would it change the taste of the cigarette?
No. Nicotine doesn't contribute to taste at all. The taste is contributed to
the
tar.
Why do you think people didn't smoke the non-nicotine cigarettes?
Because they're not addictive.
They wanted to be addictive.
Absolutely.
Well, they don't give you the kick that a cigarette gives you. And, you know, an addict needs a dose, and it gives you a feeling of well-being and the other feelings that tobacco smoke gives smokers.
Well, they could hire Victor back, and he could come up with something that would give that kick without being addictive.
Trials have begun to determine schedules of nicotine reduction that could safely wean all of the current addicts off of smoking, off of cigarette dependence. That's the angle that's being pursued by the FDA. A vast majority of Americans agree that they don't want young people in the future smoking, and that they would support government regulation to reduce nicotine to the point that they are not addictive. The question is what to do with the current smokers who are addicted.
Victor, isn't your current job funded by money that comes from that tobacco settlement that you opposed?
For the most part. A lot of times the tobacco settlement dollars will go to local public health departments, and they will hire me to come in and talk to young people about science and drug addiction. So some of the money, it's really kind of nice that I'm actually being paid by the tobacco industry to tell kids about the tobacco industry. I like that.
So you do a PowerPoint demonstration for kids in high schools?
Actually, elementary, middle, high school, and college, yes. It's a PowerPoint presentation, and it talks about the science of drug addiction and the work we did actually inside Philip Morris. I actually bring the kids into the laboratory that we had existing over 30 years ago.
Now, Charles, I imagine you're no longer threatened with a lawsuit when you make a film like this, but have you heard anything from the tobacco industry?
I think way below their radar, and there are a lot of very serious issues that they're facing in a lot of jurisdictions. No, we haven't heard any.
Are people still suing them? Do you know?
There are some. Definitely, there are still suits out there. There are still civil suits, and there are some states that haven't signed on, and they can sue as well. When we go back to the regulation, you know, we've seen here in New York occupying Wall Street, and we've seen occupying, you know, San Francisco and Oakland, and people are asking that banking industries be regulated. Here's a visual for you. Can you imagine if 500,000 people die this year from tobacco? Can you imagine?
Still.
Yes.
Oh, but these are people who have been smoking for a long time.
Yes, it's 500,000. It's about 450,000 per year and another 50,000 from secondhand smoke. Can you imagine the visual if we took these families who have lost loved ones and they marched in Washington and said, why are we not regulating this product? I mean, that's millions of people on the street.
Well, we're actually moving in the opposite direction, aren't we? Because a lot of the candidates for president right now are calling for getting rid of the Federal Drug Administration.
There's a few people out there that are saying that the FDA isn't necessary or should be changed. And I think the FDA is doing an okay job for what they have to do. They have a massive job to do with a seemingly not a very big budget.
And cigarettes are just a small part of their concerns.
It's a newest part of their concern, and they have very little activity.
They have jurisdiction over all consumed products. That's a lot.
And anything that has to do with drugs.
Yes.
Also, yes.
Which is, of course, nicotine.
Correct.
Nicotine is just natural to tobacco?
Yes, naturally. It's natural to the tobacco plant, just like, you know, opium is natural to the poppy plant.
I think the disclosures in the 90s, all of these, all of the information that came out with the documents and the testimony led to led to the Judge Kessler's RICO finding when it's the largest civil suit. It started during the Clinton administration, in the history of the Department of Justice. And in 2006, Judge Gladys Kessler filed a lengthy opinion, 1,700 plus pages, that found the industry guilty of organized crime, of racketeering, of conspiring to defraud the American people. And I think that that created the disgust in lawmakers to come together in a rare bipartisan moment during the Obama administration, and overwhelmingly Congress and Senate voted that they had to be overseen. This was a point of agreement on both sides.
And we had the law called Family Smoking Prevention Tobacco Control Act, which was signed by President Obama in 2009. Just one more thing before you go. Victor, I'm sure that there are a lot of people out there who still smoke, who are listening to this and saying, he's telling me that I shouldn't smoke. Why would anybody tell me what I should do with my own body?
Actually, I'm not telling them they shouldn't do that. I think it is your choice. If you've got addicted to nicotine, I'm not here to tell you not to smoke. I'm here to prevent your kids from smoking. I want kids to make a better decision.
Victor DeNoble, Charles Evans Jr., the film Addiction Incorporated, premieres today at the Film Forum on West Howson Street and runs through December 27th. Thank you both so much for being on our show.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Leonard.